The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Don't use a cold open of us talking about doing cold open. We can't break the fourth wall. Kia ora koutou, this is Con by Lunchtime. I'm Toby Manhire with Ben Thomas, Annabelle Lee Mather. Thank God it's February. It's a very busy January. Shout out to Samuel, who is not here today because he is rescuing his home, which is marooned somewhere out in West Auckland, I think. Te ahi, thank you for stepping in.
Kia ora, morena.
To produce us. Really is an underwater paradise here in Auckland at the moment. We'll come to that. We'll talk all about that, the response to the floods. The general sense of gloom, all of that. But first, let's talk about central politics, which obviously has a crossover into the response to the Auckland flooding. And let's talk about Chris Hipkins' first few days as Prime Minister. Let's talk about the polls. Let's talk about the reshuffle, which came yesterday. And I know how you get excited by a reshuffle, Ben.
My column was just two weeks too early.
Did you? You predicted some of the stuff right, didn't you, this time?
I got the low-hanging fruit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was it, in summary? Basically, as predicted on this podcast, Aisha Varell was made Minister of Health, replacing Andrew Little. She's a real-life doctor, a physician, so the sector will like that a lot. They will prefer her bedside manner to Andrew Little, who pushed through some reforms, was quite a hard case on pay and shortages, but also achieved some things. Meanwhile, in education, Jan Tinetti, who guested on our podcast when we did that live in Tauranga.
She's a massive fan of the show.
Is she?
She got on the Gone by Lunchtime elevator to success.
Mm-hmm.
Trod by so many before.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Normally they're our producers though, aren't they?
Never too late or too early.
Mm-hmm.
She replaces Chris Hipkins, who has been reshuffled to the role of Prime Minister. Hasn't taken on any other of the what he called symbolic gesture roles, with an accidental burn of Helen Clark, Jacinda Ardern, John Key. Michael Wood is another climber. He moved up seven spaces and gets associate finance and a new Auckland minister role. Maybe we want to talk about that a bit more. Did he get something else new as well? He hung on to immigration, workplace relations and transport, so he's got a shitload.
He got associate finance.
He got associate finance.
Which is, right. Ooh, good place to be if you're a minister.
Puts him very much in the inner circle. I'm not sure what the latest is on kitchen cabinet. I assume he'd probably be in there now.
Well, Hipkins talked about the leadership group being relatively the same and being those top five of himself, Robertson, Carmel Cipollone, Kelvin Davis and Megan Woods.
Okay. Pēni Henare lost defence, which was picked up by Andrew Little. Anything else stick out for you, Annabelle? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought that one was an interesting switch. Penny losing Minister of Defence, where I think he's done quite a good job, seems well liked, sort of in his wheelhouse. I would have thought that perhaps ACC would go to Little. I think with his union background, you know, understanding the challenges that workers face after they've been injured, that perhaps he would be better suited to a role like that. I think, you know, there's lots of evidence that ACC is underperforming in terms of, you know, having an equitable approach to Māori, Pacifica, men, women, all of that stuff. And so I would have thought that that would have been a good role for him. So I was surprised to
Doesn't strike me as one of the most sought-after portfolios.
It's a tough one.
Defence and we're offering you instead ACC.
I think that ACC is actually something Little would be very good at. And I think privately he's got some ideas on how to fix it. What sort of has happened is that Hipkins, and this was something that I addressed in my column, which was immediately superseded by the Prime Minister's resignation.
Oh, wait, Penny Hennery's got ACC, not Little.
Yeah, Penny Hennery's got ACC. Yeah. Which is that these reshuffles, they're the sorts of things, they're kind of like... it's almost like sort of fourth formers ranking celebrities in terms of attractiveness or something. It's this thing that a lot of thought goes into that nobody else really pays attention to sort of outside. But you can see in the movements that Hipkins has tried to sort of do what he, you know, a refresh to try and make the government look like it's got a bit of a new coat of paint, particularly in those problem areas that have been drawing a lot of attention. Three Waters is the obvious one, which we'll come back to. But health, where, you know, Little has been in sort of, you know, kind of fiery public confrontation with the nurses, and a courageous prime minister would have kept him there and given him defence to sort out the issue once and for all.
Him in the Air Force.
You can see that, you know, there has been actually not ruthless, but certainly dedicated culling of what used to be called sort of dead wood, the people that they don't see a future for and don't see a particular role for in the election.
It
hasn't been widespread, but you can see it where it's happened. So poor old Phil Twyford finally shuffled off from his beloved disarmament portfolio, where he's apparently been the only minister who's actually ever done anything and sort of...
On disarmament. Been working really hard.
Yeah, that's right. You know, apparently sort of, you know, when he got the portfolio, some officials have been kind of comas at MFAT for a few years, just sort of a cryogenic freeze, was sort of woken up, you know, and kind of briefed about the end of the Cold War and then set about their duty with disarmament. And he got a lot of respect for what he did in, you know, reinvigorating that portfolio. Hipkins has obviously thought that, you know, a minister who had 3 years in cabinet, he actually, you know, had some very solid policy wins, but unenviably was the face for these complete dream policies like 100,000 homes for Kiwi Build and Auckland Light Rail in 3 years.
And he was hubristic. You know, we talked about that years ago on this podcast.
Oh, look, he's a man
while he was still in there. He was promising the sky.
Phil Twyford will never die from a medical lack of self-confidence. Like, you know, I think, you know, even a year into Kiwi Build, the only person who believed that Phil could produce 100,000 homes was Phil. And,
okay, but at the same time,
so he's shuffled right, off. But,
Phil
but, but
who in else, terms of the. Who rege- else is being shuffled off the mortal coil of
well,
politics?
Well, so Nanaia has been allowed to keep foreign affairs, obviously.
Yeah.
Local government obviously taken away. But what's happened is that some of these, you know, more senior members, and Little is one of them, Nanaia Mahuta is another one, have been kind of, you know, pushed out of the front bench because in beehive speak and in the political, you know, insider land, you know, there's a massive difference between being number 16 and number 5, right? That's front bench versus back bench, second bench. And so, you know, in the calculus that the Prime Minister is approaching this, he's thinking, well, Kitty Allen is now 7. That's a big sign of rejuvenation for our government.
And, Willie Jackson has also been promoted to the front bench. Another sign of rejuvenation.
Well, I think this is where you see the balancing act that he had to do, which is that Penny had defence taken off him and given too little, and I think that was probably the compensation for Little being a good troop and going to the second row, because there is
nothing that male MPs love more
than being Minister of Defence. I never got it because I was never like a military head, you know, war historian guy when I was a kid. But when you get to Parliament, the way that these people covet
the defence portfolio.
Chuck on the camos and shake some hands.
Put on a flak jacket. Go and see the troops, your peers.
Just heading down to Ohakia. Yeah. Then I might nip over to Whenupai. And then I'll be in Wairu.
It's honestly wild. So I think that was his compensation. It was taken away from Peony, who, you know, probably wasn't a strong performer in that portfolio.
But it meant a lot to him. I mean, he talked at the time about, you know, family links and history.
That's right.
And so that was a blow to him. It's a blow to Nanaia to be demoted to the second row. And local government, inevitable that it was taken off her, but it still does seem like, you know, she was sacked from it, right? Mm. I mean, it was the sensible thing to do from everyone's perspective, but the narrative is she was sacked from local government because essentially that's what
happened.
So the payoff for that is that Kerry goes up from the Māori caucus onto the front bench.
Onto the front bench.
And somewhat inexplicably, Willie as well.
But these are sort of trade-off things, and these are balance things that you talk about. I guess where I would slightly disagree with you is that I think in terms of the decisions that had to be made, mostly because of the portfolios that had been vacated by the now Prime Minister, it was, with the possible exception of Henare losing defence, it was a pretty conservative reshuffle, I thought.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think there's some quite risky moves in it. Like, for example, I do think that Aisha Varell's appointment as Minister of Health will be warmly received by the health sector. But she is a first-term MP, and health is a difficult portfolio for even the most seasoned minister. So I think, and particularly in the post-COVID environment, to give a role that significant to a first-term MP seems to me quite high risk, and I think it maybe speaks to a lack of depth in that department. I think she hasn't always performed as well as what perhaps she could. And an example of that would have been the vaping legislation that got pushed through, removing like flavoured vapes from dairies, only to then have dairies selling them again by basically building a separate door into their premises. And over the year since that legislation was passed, more than 700 new speciality vape shops were opened up, and when we interviewed her about it on the Hui, she wasn't able to really put up a compelling argument about why that was the case. So I think, you know, health is going to be a big issue over the election campaign, and I think National will come after her quite hard. So it's a lot of responsibility that's been put on her shoulders.
There'll be a lot of expectation for her to smooth over things behind the scene with the sector. She comes with a head start from that. She's a professional. She's been in the sector for a long time. She can leverage personal relationships, her knowledge of the issues. But that said, you know, as you said, health is basically a black hole portfolio. Mm. It has limitless demands in terms of what you could be spending money on and limited funds. It's almost the sort of perfect illustration of the problems of government and sort of trade-offs. Mm. And so you can never keep everyone happy in health. It's just impossible. Mm. I think Varell is probably to be expected from, you know, a research clinician who has sort of found herself in Parliament and as a minister in her first term. She's not the most assured media performer, and she's not the most assured sort of, you know, political operative. I mean, makes sense. Mm. And so there will be a lot of expectation that she'll be able to manage things behind the scenes because, you know, if things start sort of spilling out into public, she's probably not the safest pair of hands to be fronting, you know.
That's right. And Andrew Liddell was, while he was, you know, not loved at all within the sector, he was someone who would appear routinely firefighting in the media and elsewhere when these events crop up. You know, like most recently we've got the situation with Dunedin Hospital. That's just the most immediate challenge, but they're just going to keep rolling down the slipway, aren't they? What about Auckland? We're going to talk, I promise, about Auckland at more length shortly, but Michael Wood has been appointed Minister for Auckland issues. I think it's Minister for Auckland. We noted on this podcast sort of about 300 years or a week ago that Simeon Brown had been announced as in a much overlooked because Jacinda Ardern resigned shortly afterwards, had been announced as the spokesperson for Auckland. And so now we've got Michael Wood. Michael Wood is going to have to fist fight Wayne Brown and Simeon one after the other, I suppose. Is that a good shout, do you think, Annabelle? I mean, it's kind of partly symbolic, but also presumably has a coordination role. You know, I think that's how Judith Tizard had it structured back in the Kellen Clark years. It's the you know, symbolic.
I think that's how they explained it in a press release. So.
I mean, that was pre-Super City, right? So it was sort of designed in order to, you know, push through that process, which had a whole bunch of councils coming together.
Well, this time, I think it was kind of designed to keep Judith Tizard busy, wasn't it? I mean, you would certainly hope that the Michael Wood role is more of a response to, you know, first of all, what's been happening in Auckland and the fact that Auckland has felt neglected. You know, there is that sort of trope of Jacinda Ardern never visited Auckland during its lockdown. Now, as a media person, I sort of see the sense in that because everyone's locked in their homes. She can't exactly go for a walkabout, right? Like, what does she do? Just walk down an empty street for the cameras? Yeah, it doesn't really make sense. But there is this perception that the government, and, you know, we got that as well. We got an email from somebody going, can you guys stop talking about the lockdown? Not everyone lives in Auckland.
Haters.
You know? And there is that sort of feeling, you know, that probably coalesced and, you know, and contributed towards his wish at Wayne Brown's victory last year, that, you know, Wellington sort of forgot about Auckland. And the Judith Tizard role, you know, when this role first existed, really, why, you know, she was endlessly sort of parodied, you know, the Minister of Wine and Cheese, the Minister of blah, blah. And it seemed like sort of payoff for one of, you know, Clark's loyalists, basically. But Michael Wood's a very different politician from Judith Tizard. You know, he's a very serious operator. There will be a question as to, yeah, how it works. Is his role just to make sure that he's bringing in Google alerts from Auckland to Cabinet and saying, hey, have you guys thought of this, on the assumption that a lot of Wellington-based ministers won't have? Or, you know, does he get officials supporting him, you know, from whether it's MB, DIA, you know, a kind of one of these kind of cross vote and cross departmental sort of task forces that supposedly the new Public Service Act makes easier. So, you know, still to be seen. If anyone can make it work, probably Michael Wood. He's been a very capable minister. Looks great with smouldering look under his tousled wet hair and his bomber jacket, having come from surveying the damage.
Yeah, just coming back to your point earlier, Tobe, like, he's from Mount Roskill, so I reckon he'll be quite good at fist fights. I think that it's a wise move. Like, Auckland is the economic engine room of Aotearoa, and everywhere you look, we've got major problems and challenges like transport, infrastructure, health, all of that stuff. So I think it's a wise move. And also just bad vibes. Like, lockdown, bad vibes, bad weather, bad vibes. So I think it's a smart move to have a minister for Auckland. But what I want to know is, because I saw that Luxon announced a hunting and fishing portfolio. So why didn't Labor appoint a minister for hunting and fishing?
Would that be Michael Wood as well?
No, that'd be Kieran, obviously.
Kieran McNulty.
Kieran McNulty crashing through into a clearing in the woods in his ute, just running over a deer and then just chucking it on the hood.
McNulty is one of three, I think, new entrants.
He's rural affairs, so I think that probably counts.
Well, he's local. He picks up local government, but he's kind of been doing that. He's been on a permanent tour of the regions, I think, for the last nine months or something.
Going and seeing redneck mayors and having a pint and saying, mate, we're not all lefty, bloody
bureaucrats.
You know?
Yeah. And then Ginny Anderson, another hut prodigy.
Yeah, that was a bit left field. But I suppose she's been around for a few, you know, couple of terms.
What are her portfolios again? Hut mafia, isn't it?
Economy and communications, seniors, small business, and then a couple of associate portfolios. So it's like, I mean, it's a kind of...
The kind of grab bag you sort of give.
You could get outside cabinet a grab bag like that.
Yeah.
And then finally Barbara Edmonds, who was also quite widely tipped and is widely admired, comes in with internal affairs. Yep. Takes that from Jan Tinetti. And Pacific Peoples. So there we go. Let's move on.
And, can I say Duncan Webb,
interestingly enough, took over the Commerce and Consumer Affairs portfolio, which I think Luke Malpas might have noted. That's an interesting one because he's outside of Cabinet. Probably an argument for putting Webb inside Cabinet. He's, you know, he's a good operator. He's a very successful lawyer. He's a smart guy, good party man.
So he'll
be outside Cabinet. Commerce and Consumer Affairs has been a very active portfolio for Labor because they've really leaned on these market studies to kind of get under the hood of problem in, or what they see as problem industries, and sort of apply the newfound interventionism that sort of has become, you know, much more acceptable sort of since COVID. And it does seem strange. Commerce and Consumer Affairs used to be separate portfolios. Commerce always used to be a Cabinet portfolio. And I think Craig Foss sort of rode it out of Cabinet in the Key government. Mm. And since then, it's been the sort of outside and sometimes dipped in, but with, you know, when Chris Farfoy was doing it. And it's become a sort of a minor portfolio, which certainly doesn't reflect the importance and significance.
Not
that
when
it has
you
under
look at the action on supermarkets, the action on Jibboard and other associated things.
I was just going to say, I think from a Māori perspective, from, you know, what I've seen on social media, that there is a feeling that Nanaia Mahuta has been hard done by, and you know, it is a big drop, and while you could argue that it was a very pragmatic decision by Hipkins, given that Three Waters has become really bogged down with sort of the racist rhetoric around it. And Karen McNulty is obviously well-liked in the regions. I think that many Māori see it as a bit of an insult to Nanaia and perhaps kowtowing to some of that rhetoric. I think, too, that it was always going to be really difficult to manage those portfolios for the reasons that we've talked about. You know, MFAT requiring you to be out of the country, while local government, you need to be out in the rohe all the time. And I'm not sure that even by removing her from that portfolio, it will make the passage of Three Waters any easier. But it might shift the dial on what the debate is about. I think it was great to see Willow Jean becoming a minister outside of Cabinet. You know, she's known for being meticulous, really hardworking. She has massive support in her electorate. I do think there was a missed opportunity with her, and that she probably should have been given Minister for Treaty Settlements or Associate Minister for Treaty Settlements. A lot is made of people like Aisha Varel, who has a health background, or Karen McNulty, you know, in terms of being a farmer. But Willow Jean has worked in the treaty space for decades and has a fantastic reputation. So why you wouldn't appoint her to a role like that when there seems to have been quite little ground made over the last few years, I think is curious.
Yeah, I mean, there is a question, and it came up when Calvin Davis was the spokesperson in opposition on Crown Māori relations, and more recently, a couple of years ago, when Shane Leti said that he would, was Treaty Negotiations spokesperson for National, which is that a lot of these high-profile and very experienced and very capable candidates for Treaty of Waitangi negotiations are Napui, and the one big remaining settlement, you know, on the agenda. You know, the settlements are about sort of 80% concluded or so, and a lot of that is sort of smaller ones, or ones where progress has sort of stalled for various reasons. The big one is Napui, the largest iwi by a long way. And, you know, there is the issue, and people have got different ideas about whether it's a conflict. If you fuck up in Napui, and then you would be the Treaty Negotiations Minister and dealing with those issues.
Which is interesting, because nobody says that about Pākehā ministers for the Crown, who are also, you could argue, have a conflict of interest by virtue of the fact that they, A, represent the Crown, and are tangata tiriti.
I mean, the Crown is more.
Does it make it a conflict of interest for people who have come from a particular industry or background to be ministers within those industries?
Probably if they remain part of that industry during the same time. This does come up with farmers, you know, sometimes, and, you know, what can they be part of in terms of policy discussions. And so, you know, like, I think there's arguments for both things, but it was interesting that Ginny Anderson was named the Associate Minister for Treaty of Waitangi Negotiations, because, one, it's not a portfolio where you often have associate ministers. Mm. And second of all, really not clear what her background is in that space or what she would do as an associate. So, you know, who knows, watch this space.
Come back to Three Waters. You know, we're expecting the kind of next act in the play will be the purging of the policies, having had the reshuffle complete. And there was some kind of eye out for any clues in this, but Willie Jackson retains broadcasting media, so he gets a promotion to the front bench. And Nanaia, as widely predicted, no longer has local government. There's some discussion about whether or not it might presage some watering down of the co-governance elements within Three Waters. The first bill has gone through, but they could change things in it. I mean, there seem to be sort of a few mixed messages in terms of the level of attachment to the legislation as it stands.
So Hipkins said we will not be dumping it.
Yeah.
But we will be looking closely at it, and there may be an opportunity for a reset.
Yeah.
Whatever the hell that means, right?
Yeah, exactly. But Hipkins goes, I think his first appointment at Waitangi would be in the Iwi Chairs Forum, which is whenever it is, late end of this week probably. And, you know, is he going to go there and say, hello, we thought we might just change the wording here so that it's just need to have a conversation with Iwi in appointing the...
Well, I think it would...
Will that wash?
I think that there is a reason that he isn't on the policy reset before he goes to Waitangi, right? And now there's a declaration. I've done work on Three Waters for clients, but... One of the interesting things is, and I've been thinking about this, you know, what do you do to reset or walk back or whatever Three Waters, right, in the current form, to make it, first of all, acceptable to the critics, and second of all, to achieve the goals that you're trying to achieve. And it's very hard, you know. I mean, I can understand why whoever's putting together the bullet points for Hipkins when he first becomes Prime Minister goes, oh, one of the things we'll do is we'll... ameliorate Three Waters, or we'll reset Three Waters, or we'll tweak it, or whatever. When you actually start getting into it, it's hugely complex, and you try and figure out what you could actually do. You can't dump it, and they've ruled that out because, you know, you've already got $12 million contract signed on office buildings in Auckland. It would go
CEOs
down.
Appointed for the entities now.
They've spent about $1 billion bucks or something, right? It would go down. It would make Kiwi Build look like, you know, a sort of... aborted sort of, film script or something in terms of the government waste, right? And you could talk about, one of the fixes that's been suggested widely is sort of, you get rid of the regional representative groups, which is the co-governance sort of part where you've got half council representatives, half iwi representatives, and you make, and they don't actually do the governance of the entity themselves, they just appoint the board, right? But my understanding, or my read of what has previously been said, is that the operational separation, which was necessary to get the stuff off the council balance sheets, meant that you couldn't have purely councils, at any level, you know, of the organisation sort of dictating strategic intent, etc. So if you get rid of the RRGs, well, first of all, if you get rid of the RRGs, you don't have the council reps. So presumably you have an RRG that's, you know, or the councils appoint everything. But then there's a question about that operational separation. So does the model still work? And because it's so complex, it's like kind of playing Jenga with pocket knives, you know? It's any part that you take out is, you know, makes it incredibly difficult. So, I mean, you know, I will be watching that space.
And even then, if you do all that, if you don't placate some of the people who have been hollering it needs to change, then, you know, if they're like, well, that's just the same thing.
And the thing is...
Then even if it does change in some way in substance, it's not the point, really, is it? The point is...
Well, the thing is, if the formal objection of the mayors and communities for local democracy in these groups is that it removes the community, so-called ownership, of the assets, right? So, in theory... In theory,
I love that.
The objection is not the co-governance, right? In theory, the objection is the removal of ownership to these entities.
Yes.
Now, unpicking that is much, much, much more complex. So I don't think there's anything you can do that would actually get the approval of the critics at this stage. So I, you know, sorted out over a few beers, I guess, with Kieran McNulty, but... you know, I think that's going to be a very difficult one to back off from, unlike, say, the TVNZ-RNZ merger, where you basically just lose the cabinet paper behind a desk and then it's over.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
All right. Let's talk briefly about the polls. We had the rare treat of simultaneous polls on One News and News Hub on, was it Monday evening, I think? And they were remarkably the same, weren't they? In that they presented essentially a neck and neck state of play. They saw a pretty significant bump for Labour under Hipkins. They saw the kind of block head to head, pretty much even Stevens, with National Act very slightly still ahead of Labour Green. They shone the spotlight once again on Te Pāti Māori as a potential kingmaker, King Chrismaker. And there were a few other interesting details in there, I thought. Interestingly, in the One News Kantar poll, the level of pessimism about the economy had dropped. I mean, people are still more pessimistic than they are optimistic, but less pessimistic than they had been in November by a specific margin. The other one was not just the preferred prime minister, where Hipkins leads Luxon by a nose. But I don't know if you guys alighted on this. It was in the News Hub poll. There was a trust question, which I think more than anything will be the one that national strategists will be looking at closely, which is, do you trust the leaders? 53% said yes for Christopher Hipkins. 37% said yes for Christopher Luxon, 27% no for Hipkins, 44% no for Luxon. And that's a little bit of a worry, isn't it, Annabelle,
it's if you're interesting,
9 months out from an election?
It's interesting because it shows that, like, even though you may not support Hipkins, that you still trust him, like, even if he's not your preferred prime minister, that you find him trustworthy, whereas with Luxon, it's literally only the people that support him that find him trustworthy. I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the polling in general shows that Labour did exactly the right thing at the beginning of the year, which, you know, following Ardern's resignation, which was that tack towards the centre, you know, the cosy club, the working man from the hut.
Yes, and not just but also doing it so efficiently and so smoothly and without the bloodletting that recent years have taught us voters hate.
Yeah, absolutely. So he nailed the messaging, but more importantly than that, voters have found the messaging credible coming from Hipkins. They genuinely believe that he's going to take a laser focus to cost of living, that he's going to, you know, dial back on co-governance, whatever that turns out to be, and, you know, distractions. You know, people believe, you know, look, he's focused on doing the job at hand.
Now, the downside to that is that now there'll be an expectation that he does all that stuff and, you know, that nothing has changed.
So people like the rebrand, right? But then what's inside the store is
That's right. The pressure is now on him to deliver that stuff. And, you know, again, so what I just talked about, it's going to be harder to step away from Three Waters than I think people anticipate. It's going to be, in terms of how do we laser-like come up with new ways to address the cost of living crisis. Well, we saw today and stuff that they're planning on increasing the duration of the fuel excise subsidy.
Yeah, I say we're talking on the morning of Wednesday, February the 1st, and there's an announcement at lunchtime in Auckland, and it's expected to be, as you say, a extension of the cut to fuel tax and public transport half price.
And there's a number of economists, people like Brad Olson from Metrics and Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative, who criticise that as a policy, saying that three times the amount goes to higher income earners through the fuel subsidy then goes to lower income earners, and that direct cash transfers would be a better way of addressing this for low income earners because you get less sort of waste in terms of people who, you know, are obviously doing it harder than before but are not actually materially struggling.
It's also an enormously popular policy. Oh,
this is the thing. People love it, right?
Thanks, economists.
But it's certainly not... It's not fresh thinking, right? It's policy that's been in place for almost a year now.
Is it bread and butter?
It is bread and butter, but it's not necessarily fresh thinking.
Bread, butter,
they've still got to figure out, you know,
rich, tasty petrol.
Because bread and dips. You've still got to figure out what to do when inflation, you know, hopefully it's plateaued or peaked and it's coming down, but, you know, as I think Janae Tibbs-Schraney, the Wellington business editor for the Herald, said, fixing Auckland is going to, you know, that's going to, you know, put more pressure on construction costs and capacity, some of the things that have been driving inflation. So, you know, none of the sort of external stuff has really changed. And so it's still going to be very difficult for Labor to actually pull off this rebrand. National still has the luxury of sort of saying, well, things would be better if we were in charge, and not, you know, not being able to or not having to, you know, actually be in the hot seat, you know, for the next 9 months. Where National are going to be worried, though, is there's that trust rating and the falling net approval for Luxon. They've obviously lost some momentum, and when I sort of think about it, I think they haven't really gotten any clear messaging out from the leadership of the party for a couple of months now. Mm. There is this sort of pattern of, you know, Luxon will say things, it'll either be misinterpreted or he misspoke, and Nicola Willis will sort of sweep in behind and tidy it up. And Willis herself got into a bit of trouble with the minimum wage stuff. Mm. And the thing is, previously, especially because, you know, Labor have been seen as not focused on cost of living, National haven't had to say what they would do concretely except focus on cost of living. If Chris Hipkins says, I'm going to focus on cost of living as well, well, it's, you know, Spider-Man pointing at each other. You've both got the same policy, which is to make everything better and easier for people. So then people start becoming interested in specifics, which is really annoying. Right? And and National, you know, they don't have the specific policies in a lot of cases right now.
Yeah, so it'll probably drive them into more of the policy rollout. We'll have to, I mean, Annabelle, and to some degree, you know, I think that there was, I'm not sure when it was planned for, I can't recall, normally in January we have sometimes the State of the Nation speeches, these set pieces, which, you know, don't have a whole lot of flesh on the bone, but Christopher Luxon maybe postponed his, I don't know. I mean, when you've got a crisis in Auckland, a weather crisis, then obviously the people who are elected as well and take on leadership roles, and then also Wayne Brown does what he does. But... you know, there's not been any oxygen for National, but do you think they will be rethinking with the new Prime Minister the way that they approach the year, whether or not a small target works, whether or not they need to be a bit more out front in delivering some policy detail earlier on in the piece?
Yeah, I think towards the end of last year, they found some quite fertile ground that they were able to use to really hold the government's feet to the fire, like the ram raids, the cost of living. I think it's going to be difficult to maintain the narrative around that. And so I think potentially we could see them starting to gingerly float some potential policy ideas so that they can start speaking to their own agendas.
Let's talk about Auckland. Annabelle, Friday night, I was in the Bay of Plenty and just scrolling my phone, just looking at social media, and it was very clear to me, looking at the photos that people were posting, just some normie, not even in the city, that what was happening. It didn't seem obvious to officialdom. The mayor was nowhere. The emergency authorities were pretty much nowhere. Waka Kotahi logged off. I mean, what a shit show.
Yeah. Yeah, but I was driving back from Swanson at 3 PM, and it was like a really scary drive just trying to get back to Point Chef from there. It was so, the rain was so heavy, and I'm sure at that point the warning bells must have been going off, you know, somewhere. Apparently not, though. But I think it kind of speaks to this weird culture that we have in New Zealand when it comes to these emergency situations. It's almost like we get so caught up in red tape that we're not able to respond. It's sort of like what happened with Whakaari when, you know, people weren't allowed to, you know, when the emergency responders were, like, turned away from the island or Pike River or those sorts of things. We're almost so risk-averse in risky situations that nothing happens.
Except if Phil Goff, hardly a man renowned for, you know, hall-filling charisma, had been mayor of Auckland at the time, would he not have done the basic requirements of a municipal leader in such a situation, which is communicating with people, providing the very latest information, forgetting for a second even about the declaration of the state of emergency, which became the hook onto which everything was hung.
Absolutely.
Giving people a sense of assurance, but also being curious, also saying, I'm seeking answers.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find stuff out because I'm the person who has access to all the different authorities because I'm the fucking mayor. And yet when he appears, when he does eventually appear in the media, and, you know, I mean, who cares about whether he hates the media or the media hates him? When he eventually appears, his answers to questions like, is the water safe to drink? Like, were text messages sent out as, I don't know.
I think, absolutely he would have. But I think that the best example of how a mayor should perform in a crisis situation was Bob Parker, you know, who was always front and centre,
yep.
Really clear messaging, you know, comforting, all of those things. And but clearly that is not within Brown's skill set or even in his own opinion of what his role is. And it's all fine to be a Mr. Fixer as he sold himself. But, you know, being a mayor isn't just about telling people where a wharf should be. It's about being able to respond and provide leadership in these situations. And on that front, he's failed abysmally.
Ben, you worked for Wayne Brown during the campaign. You haven't since shortly after the campaign, as mm-hmm. I understand it. So yep. I don't know how much you want to get into this particular issue. Obviously, he had a moment in terms of his electability. It was a very good campaign. It spoke to concerns Aucklanders had. But what's happened? Why? I mean, he obviously really hates the media, and fine, right? You know, whatever. Drongos is quite sweet. I quite like Drongos. You know, that's quite sweet. But he seems sort of obsessing on this thing about whether he's been treated, you know, rather than being able to just step up and above and speak to the people more broadly.
Yeah, in terms of the initial response, look, I don't know, it totally passed me by as well. I was
Well, you're not the mayor.
I headed out at about 5:45 p.m. on Friday, and I knew that, you know, there had been a warning issued to stay safe out there or something, and so I thought, okay, I'll drive to the conditions. And, you know, I didn't really realise the extent of it. You know, I thought it was a rainy night on K Road, you know, but I didn't realise the extent of what it sort of was happening.
Are you sure you're not still advising the mayor?
To be fair, K Road is at the top of a ridge where water runs down both sides, so you're probably like in the safest place in Auckland.
No, that's right. And there were torrents of water coming down, you know, sort of next to my house, sort of down to whatever is beneath my house. Don't know, not interested. And so I did a bit of like parkour to get to my car. But, you know, I thought, oh, it's just heavy rainfall, you know. So I didn't actually realise, you know, about all the flooding and stuff until I was like perusing TikTok later that night. And this seems to have been a real problem, right? The emergency, for what it's worth, I believe His Worship, you know, Wayne Brown, when he says that he didn't, you know, he wasn't made aware of it.
Because other councillors were all over social media posting all sorts of different messages. And you don't need, like, the head of the emergency response to tell you what's up. Like, he could literally have just come out and said, everyone, for a start, try and stay out of the floodwaters. Like, he could have used his socials for basic messaging, like common sense stuff.
The thing. Like, I actually believe there was an information gap, you know, in that kind of critical period up to, what do you
think? Does he not have windows? Can he not, like, look out the window shit's getting real?
Yeah. When I worked in Parliament, right, I think we come back early from a holiday or something, and Finlayson, my boss, was the duty minister at the time, and there was a quake somewhere in New Zealand, and as the duty minister, you know, suddenly we had DIA officials rushing up to sort of escort him to the bunker, you know, there's stuff being put out in front of him, and you know, and then we sat there for about half an hour and there's nothing to do, and then we got sent away, you know, but I think in terms of the emergency responses,
Wayne couldn't do that, Ben, because Wayne didn't go to the office until 4 o'clock.
I think you probably do assume that, you know, well, I've always assumed that the emergency sort of service people, you know, because you always see them in the emergencies and you're like, these people are superhuman. They know all about what's happening. They have, you know, earthquake sensors, you know, around the country or whatever. You know, I have numerous correspondents who will, you know, who have worked at the council before and will, you know, seem to take an interest in telling me their thoughts on the new mayor's progress. And the consensus does actually seem to be that the emergency management division of the council is not great.
Both things can be true, can't they?
Yeah, like, that's right.
Both things can be true.
I think the fact that that an emergency alert, the great howl in the pocket, the flashing light mobile phone thing, emerged 48 hours later when there was something else coming on, you know, which was definitely of a lower magnitude than what was going down on Friday. That clearly, like, what something was not going on. It's good that the mayor has said there will be a review. It's good that he said that review will include every part of the operation, including his. The trouble was that after he read that really quite dignified statesman-like statement out that I suspect somebody else had written for him, he then got back into a shouting match
Say the most bizarre thing about the press conference on Saturday was the deputy mayor, like, dragging him away by the arm. That was weird.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, auntie, what's up?
Also, Desley Simpson, by the way, has been on all the radio stations just going and sort of patiently answering the question. Like, that's a kind of shitty thing to do. But just sometimes being present is important. You know, one of the other things that I was reminded of when all this was going on, and this is, you know, it's the comparison isn't perfect, but do you remember when there were floods in Northland, and John Carter did this incredible bit on the radio, the mayor at the time, with Catherine Ryan. It was the tsunami warning.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was driving round the small towns and the far north.
Dude, you've got to get up the hill.
You know, no, forget your milk. Go and get up the hill. No. Yeah, no, I'm just going. And it was like that.
Wayne should have texted the tennis group chat. Then it would have gotten out pretty well.
Yeah. But like, there's sometimes that stuff isn't. He said, I shouldn't be out there emptying buckets. Like, well, maybe you should, mate, because if you're a leader, sometimes you lead by example. Beyond that, you also, even when this bad stuff is happening behind you, so taken, I believe him too, that he wasn't advised in the right way, but what was he doing? Was he not demanding questions? And then the other thing you do, and I don't think this is very complicated, if you're a leader, you take responsibility. And even if it's not, you know, it doesn't mean that you go, it doesn't mean that you specifically are responsible for everything. You take responsibility as a leader. You say, things didn't go right. I take responsibility for that, and I will be demanding answers in the hours and days to come.
The other thing too that makes, that kind of shook my confidence was during the bizarre press conference when he kept pulling up the guy from, is it emergency services,
yeah, the other dude.
And it seemed like their priority wasn't really about explaining what was going on. It was about covering Wayne's butt. And it's like, hang on, what, are you guys here to take care of us, or are you here Sinella to like placate?
Fonseca, who's a very good PR person, she noted on Twitter, I think, after that first press conference, you know, the one late at night at 11:20 p.m. on, was it around the end of Friday, she said, it seems like the mayor is addressing his critics on Twitter rather than the people of Auckland. Mm. And I thought that sounded right. And then I was like, he doesn't know about Twitter. Yeah. And then I think the next morning, I think I read on the spin-off that he said, well, you know, I do what the experts advise me, not what people on Twitter want. Yeah. And then I was like, who the hell told him about Twitter?
Who printed out tweets and put them in front of them?
This is the worst thing you can do for any politician, is like tell them about what, you know, what Twitter is saying.
That is absolutely true. But the other side of this is that it's, you know, Twitter is terrible. Social media is terrible. Okay, accept it. But at a time like this, you realise where and when it's really useful. Because if he had an established account, even if it was dormant, even if it was someone else, then he would have been able to issue short messages without having to appear on the radio on Friday night and throughout, channeled through a communications person saying, I'm aware of these things. For the moment, check these websites. We'll be providing more answers soon. And then that is disseminated, radiated around through the community. It's really valuable. Chloe Swarbrick, the MP for Auckland Central, sort of had stopped using Twitter because it had become so horrible and people were so awful. But she, you know, revived her account, started using it for those kind of civil defence purposes.
I think the thing is, if you hadn't, like, ever seen Wayne Brown in action before, and that press conference was your first time watching him, which could be the case because, what does he refuse, like 102 media requests or something?
Oh, that was just the first month.
In the first month. But he actually seems to not have the capability to communicate clearly or effectively. Like, there was those strange long pauses between different things, and he's sort of poking at his iPhone and getting befuddled. And for most people, that probably was quite surprising. But actually, if you'd paid attention during the mayoral election campaign, he's not really that different to what he was like then. He just had a bit more swag because he wasn't being
genius,
held responsible
must
have been for
geniuses
anything.
That managed to get him elected then, right?
I think that's a fair comment. And he, you know, he was pretty open during the campaign. You know, he characterised it as, you know, I'm not going to be a mayor who's at every opening and kissing babies and things like that. And I think that was a metaphor, a figure of speech, for the broader kind of
for basic requirements of leadership.
The communications, the public communications role is not one that he relishes or has sort of comparative strengths in.
Yeah.
I think that's
definitely
true. But it's so critical, though.
You know,
oh, yeah, at times like this, absolutely.
It's a critical part of leadership.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that there was something... It was almost like the storm on Friday was kind of like an Ocean's 11 style heist or something. You know, it waited until the change in shifts of Waka Kotahi and council workers and AT and whoever. And it seems that everyone was either knocking off and being like, oh, well, four motorways are closed, TGIF, see you all on Monday.
It was... Yeah, I mean, Duncan put it this way, I think, in a piece he wrote, that it was like the ultimate Friday news dump.
You know?
Nature going, look, it's January, it's a long weekend coming up, people have fucked off to the beach, to whatever, let's go.
I think this is going to be a very long 3 years for Wayne Brown because the storm has just like opened up a bit of a Pandora's box. Like we knew that, you know, he'd already said that he wasn't going to work weekends and that sort of stuff. But now that it's come out that he has like a regular tennis match booked in every Friday during working hours and he's like didn't roll into the office until 4 o'clock, I think that that's going to peak the media's curiosity and they're just going to start digging deeper and deeper and deeper. And
I think the interview requests will start coming in.
I think he really underestimated the demands of the job.
And I mean, that's the other thing is the kind of, you know, if he's sort of eschews all this nonsense, this fancy empathy rubbish, you know, he's an operator, behind the scenes operator. Well, he's the behind the scenes operator who seems to not have the trust of his most loyal 15 grumpy old men Westmere tennis group.
Apparently, there's a grumpier old man than him David, who leaked it
rings
to
up
the media.
David Fisher doesn't say we're off the record and starts going on about, you know, how everything's deals and all this sort of, you know. I mean, it's just, by the way, can we, the grumpy old men WhatsApp chat group for the Westmere Tennis Club, apparently there's, you know, there's recriminations and retributions going on in there now. I think that's the next Knives Out movie. Is the grumpy old men Westmere Tennis Club group chat WhatsApp all go to the Chateau Tongariro and try and work out who was the leaker?
You know, the thing about
only one grumpy old man emerges alive.
People are imagining this sort of brave whistleblower, you know, who's, you know, turning against his class interests or whatever. I like have this real sneaking suspicion that like probably about half an hour before David Fisher got the screenshots, there were probably a few unanswered texts going like, Brownie, can you send around the council boys to the crowd? There's been a bit of shit on the street. Well, yes. You know, Vicky Ev's getting a bit clogged up. Can you divert the army?
If anyone in Russia is listening, please provide us with the full transcripts of the Grumpy Old Men Westmere Tennis Club.
I was watching that press conference on Saturday and like Hipkins staring up at Brown like, oh my God, and how like annoyed Kieran McNulty and Michael Woods looked. And
Wood has the best poker face in the business. He was just impassive, unmoving.
It looked like, no, but it wasn't impassive though, because they both all looked like they were trying to be impassive. Like you could see the effort that was going in to keeping their
like
faces impassive.
Really
but
hard.
You know what? There's a little bit of kaitoa in this for Labor because, you know, Auckland is such a critical city and critical to Labor too. And they really took their eyes off the ball during the mayoral campaign and should have put a lot more support around a vessel if they wanted their guy to come through, and they didn't, and now they have to reap what they sowed in terms of Wayne's leadership.
Yeah, and Wayne Brown is certainly right that he got a mandate and that he won convincingly, and Auckland has put him in that role, and he's got a lot of work to do to turn things around. Should we wrap it up? Hope everyone is as safe as they can be, those that are in Auckland and other parts of the country that are affected in North and Tauranga and everywhere else. Hope you're all right. Lots of love. Chat next time. Thanks to members, especially. Bye.
Kia ora e te iwi. Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.